Hey guys, welcome to Right Owl Politics. Happy Friday. For those of you who are new to the show, welcome. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Ariana Mendez, your host, coming to you from Miami, Florida. So today's topic is about the history of talk radio, the progression of the medium, and this new offshoot, which is called podcasting. So welcome to the podcast. It's a lot of fun what we have in store today. So I started to research how talk radio came into existence. Because this concept of having a person sitting in front of a microphone and sharing their points of view on a variety of different issues feels somewhat new, but surprisingly enough, people have been sharing their stories on the airwaves, their opinions, their approach to life since the 1920s. We can trace it back to a woman, actually, Amy Semple McPherson in the 1920s. She purchased her own radio station, started her podcast in the 1920s, and it followed with a lot of fanfare. And then slowly but surely, men got into the mix in the 1930s. But political talk radio, the concept that really has stirred up so much interest from viewers as far as tuning in to get a specific person's opinion on politics specifically, that's a 1990s concept. And if you look at the history of the progression of the medium, the pioneer, the great conservative commentator Rush Limbaugh, was probably one of the first successful talk radio show hosts, and definitely took off in the 1990s right after the repeal of the Federal Communications Commission's Post-War Fairness Act of 1949. And for those of you not familiar with that, it's a mandate that said that used to say that the audience was required to be exposed to a diversity of viewpoints. So anybody who held a broadcast license had to present controversial issues of public importance and do so in a way that at that time the Federal Communications Commission viewed as honest, equitable, and balanced. That's the precise language they use. Its repeal, of course, provided an opportunity for a kind of partisan political programming that had not been seen before in that time. And its repeal is what made talk radio as a medium possible, specifically conservative talk radio. So it's a very interesting history. And of course, over the years, some other bigwigs have joined the lineup of great conservative talk radio hosts. Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, Laura Ingraham, Bill O'Reilly, Mark Levine. So the list goes on and on. But it's definitely interesting to take a moment and look back at how we got to our current state of entertainment, at least when it comes to politics. So today I wanted to invite to the show a talk radio host, somebody who's been in the game for a while, somebody who has a successful radio show, who talks about politics three times a week and knows the ins and outs of the business. And we can talk about what it's like to sit in front of a microphone, discuss your political points of view. What does that feel like? What are the challenges involved in that process? And how has the political paradigm changed in the country in recent years? And we discuss a whole slew of issues. So it was a very interesting chat. So without further ado, I want to welcome Mike Essen to the show, and let's jump right in. Hey, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ariane. I'm honored to be on Right Owl Politics with you.
So, Mike, I wanted to invite you because we launched this year, and it's been a whirlwind, a lot of good feedback, but a podcast like our show would not exist without talk radio being in existence before. And I wanted to talk to you about how you got into talk radio, how you seen the progression of the industry, and you have a very successful radio show. A lot of big wigs have been over there. So tell us, what's the secret sauce, and introduce yourself to our audience.
My name is Mike Essen. I got into talk radio because my father was a famous attorney, the late great Richard Essen, and during the O.J. Simpson trial, he became a weekly guest on someone named Steve Kane's show, former Miami talk host, now based in Fort Lauderdale. And eventually, they knew who I was. I would talk between the breaks, his co-host, Brian Craig, said, let's try this on Mike for one time a month. And I was a conservative talk show host back then, 1999, and eventually it was once every week I would co-host with Brian Craig while my dad did it with Steve Kane. And for 6 years, that was the style. I was part of the Steve Kane show. Then when podcasting came along, I decided to do my own podcasts. I had a few guests on, several very prominent, like Ben Carson, Alan West, on Blog Talk, which I'm on now. I've had Marco Rubio, Oliver North, and I've debated Gloria Allred even on an issue.
That's amazing. And really, I looked into your dad's career and history. What a remarkable man. How big of an inspiration was he for you?
Incredible. I got my debate skills and my talking skills and my ability to think for myself with critical thinking and deep thinking from him. I learned a lot from him. He was a wonderful mentor, friend, and very special person. Thank you for your compliments.
So how come you didn't follow in his footsteps and become a lawyer?
I didn't want to put the work into it. I respected the profession, but I saw a lot of strain to put on him. And I just wanted to follow my own path and be my Mike Essen instead of Richard Essen's son.
That's very fair. And as a lawyer, I can totally relate to the statement of putting it a lot on the person. It's a stressful job and you really have to put in the hours and it kind of, you know, sometimes you get home and you're like, ugh, it's been a day.
And the day starts over again very quickly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, but that's an amazing story. And were you always interested in people? Because I think if you do what we do, which is interview other people and talk to them, there must be a genuine curiosity about the person on the other side of that conversation, right?
Well, absolutely, Ariane. That's an excellent question. I find people's personalities to be a very fascinating subject. I find there's three ways I do my show. I either have a candidate on who I endorse, so I find the race is very interesting. I have a guest who I agree with, but I put a different slant to it, and I find his perspective interesting. Or I debate somebody and you find the progressive point of view very interesting. And I find people's personalities to be what makes the world go around.
So what do you think makes a good interview?
Questions that are not just talking points. A new kind of spin to it. Let me give you one example. I debated Gloria Allred on the hot button topic of abortion. And she, of course, gave the typical pro-abortion argument, it's a woman's body, I have a right to do what I want with it. Instead of saying it's the baby's body, I came up with a new argument saying, no, you can't do what you want with your body because hardcore drugs and streaking are illegal. That's one example. And also think of questions and answers or that people don't usually come up with. If you're like everybody else, why does someone want to listen to you?
Right, right. Was that hard finding that rhythm, or did it come naturally to you?
It was a little hard. At first, I was nervous to be on the air. I mean, to tell you the truth, when I first got on, I used to write down what I wanted to say because it was very difficult. But as you know, Ariana, something about talk radio that's very interesting, it's a rhythm. You do not, if anybody out there wants to go to school to become a talk show host, though, you either are discovered by accident like me, have a talent like Ariana does, and she did a wonderful job on your show, by the way, or you're a politician or celebrity who gets like Charlie Kirk or Mike Huckabee who gets a show. Because it's an innate characteristic. The chances of making a talk show and being successful at it are the same as you or me making the Red Sox.
Yes. Yeah, there's a secret sauce to it, right? One of those three, definitely.
Absolutely.
So how do you think, why is talk radio, why is even podcasting, because I strongly believe that podcasting is definitely an offshoot of talk radio, though slightly different, it's usually in shorter formatting. Talk radio shows tend to be an hour plus sometimes. Why do you think people like the medium so much?
Right now, just speaking because people have strong opinions is one thing. And because it's right now, it's the conservative version of Hollywood, academia, and the mainstream media. And it works that way because people get strong opinions. People don't, it's the op-ed piece. You hear voices, you hear conflict, and you hear agreements. You hear emotions, you hear everything that makes people want to listen to it. People generally listen to the radio in their car. One of the advantages we have in Ariana of being podcasters is people listen to the whole thing a little more often. So we have our advantages too.
And I definitely think there's an argument. If you go into the geographical location of talk radio listeners and versus podcast listeners, there's like people living in the suburbs, people that have longer commutes tend to listen to talk radio, while people that listen to podcasts may have shorter commutes, maybe more urban living or suburban living. So it's always interesting how the where and the why you listen to something plays a part into the viewership, right?
Well, absolutely. Funny enough, I'm in a very liberal county, Broward, though a lot of my listenership is in Dade, which is a purple county. But I mean, and the funny thing, but if you look at a localized level, I think if my show was only heard in Massachusetts or Hawaii or California, I would go nowhere. You neither. But because we have a more conservative bent, there definitely is a market for us here, yes.
Yeah. So politics right now is crazy, to say the least, right?
And say the least, exactly.
But you must have noticed it. I'm sure you watched the RNC convention. I noticed it, and I talked about it on my last episode, the incredible progression of the Republican Party. You know, maybe two decades ago, the Republican Party was this party, you know, had the label of elitist, you know, upper middle class. People didn't feel it was a very welcoming party. And that's not the Republican Party anymore. It's a much more middle class party, working class party, very about, you know, working class issues and providing opportunity to people. How do you see that progression? And is it because of Trump or is it a natural progression?
Mainly because of Trump and because of something I didn't like 20 years ago. I hate to say this, but George W. Bush, when he was running against Al Gore in the 2000 presidency, came up with a term I detest called compassionate conservatism. Because that implies that conservatives aren't compassionate, and he's a little different. But in the same time, Ariana, it got people to think, we're people too, we do care. But over time, you saw less cuts in business, less cuts in services, and more Black people joining, more Jewish people like myself joining, and more and my women who were very outspoken like yourself in the conservative movements. But Trump, I think, amplified that about 50%. And you could tell by Women for Trump, Blacks for Trump, because he just relates to the common people and everybody so well that they see there's a little Donald Trump in all of us.
Right. How does that change the political paradigm in the United States? Because the Democrats historically were the party of the working class, the middle class. How does that change the alignment?
There's a few things that are changing it besides I'll mention it changes it a lot, except the media would change it a lot more if the media stopped lying about it. You know, it doesn't mean anything to say I'm the party of the little man. I always hated that phrase. What does that mean? Peter Dinklage, Billy Barty. Of course, it means the common person who's working. But when Donald Trump saves the coal industry, reforms the VA hospital while Barack Obama cut VA funding. And I think the paradigm is completely shifted for people who are informed, but the media will help you believe otherwise. But now the Democrat Party, if I can go there, I want to go there for a second, Ariana.
Sure.
Has become a party of revolutionaries. If you look at the way Pol Pot, Castro, and Hugo Chavez got started, they wanted to defund the police. They tear down statues. They're banning Gone with the Wind, To Kill a Mockingbird. They promised free stuff. It's history all over again in a very, very scary way. And we're fighting for our democracy, republic as we know it.
But it is scary, but it fits the narrative historically of how the revolutionary left rises to power, because historically it was people, Fidel Castro, that came from an upper middle class family, wealthy background, educated, who fell for this Marxist-Leninist ideology and became, you know, this Robin Hood type figure and socialist and communist revolutionary. And you saw the same thing in Lenin. You have these people that come from wealthy elitist backgrounds that feel immense guilt of having that status and embrace these very dangerous ideologies of the left. And you see this on the left today here in America, where you have people in urban areas, upper middle class people who somehow have embraced these redistribution of wealth schemes and ideology and believe that that is the only way to move forward, because there is kind of this underlying current of guilt that they have for their status.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the three areas like Hollywood, super rich people, MSM, mainstream media, super rich people, and even the college professors, and they do feel guilty about it. You hear them talking about, I feel guilty about the color of my skin, I feel guilty about my wealth, I want to share my wealth, I want to, which they don't do, and they just want to share other people's money. And it's so similar, like you said, Arianna, to people from historical revolutionary communist people, that it can happen here, and it's, there's a big movement for it to happen here too, and it's called the Democrat Party.
It's a bit sad. As you know, my parents were Cuban exiles. They had everything that they owned taken away from them just simply because they were not communist in Cuba. They fled to the United States and had to start from zero. And it's interesting to speak to them, and as a Jewish man, maybe you can relate to this as well. You know, having that historical memory of what happened to your people at one point in time, riots, this kind of hatred towards other people that is unjustified. It's just pure unbridled hatred. I know, speaking to my mom, that's what she was talking about, seeing these riots, people looting. It gave her flashbacks to pre-revolutionary Cuba during that period of turmoil. And it was scary because this is no longer about, I'm a Republican, you're a Democrat, we disagree on issues, but we can get along. This is about both sides cannot even talk to each other anymore. And this has even escalated to recently to the death of a Trump supporter, outright murder of a Trump supporter. So this is devolving very quickly. This is scary stuff, Mike.
It's absolutely frightening, Arianna. And I mean, you saw the attack on Rand Paul when he was leading the RNC. And my father, who was experienced very severe anti-Semitism, is spinning in his grave now because of the things the Squad says about Jewish people, which the Democrat Party is backing. There is hatred all over the place. Antifa and Black Lives Matter are destroying the country. There's prejudice from every point of view. And it's triggering everybody and scaring everybody. I don't recognize my country, Arianna, like I used to.
And it's for me, it's mind-boggling, right? Because as conservatives, you know, historically, we haven't always been the most inclusive party, you can argue. With that said, right now, the right is the only one defending freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, of assembly. We're the ones defending those constitutional principles. The left historically had defended that and were big advocates of that, but they've devolved into violence and censorship and cancel culture. What is this? What happened to the true left? You know, the left, the Jefferson left, you know, freedom of thought, expression, more ideas are better than less, marketplace of ideas. What happened to that left?
You know, they were the same left, and I agreed with this when they used to say it. I hate the Ku Klux Klan, but I defend their right to speak. Now, in California, you can't do something which I have done on my show repetitive times and criticize climate change and deny it. And it was a slow evolution from just them saying this is dangerous or this is hate speech or this is going to cause violence, and they've been using these ridiculous excuses. And it escalated like a pyramid into just being total dictators. Because you got to remember, that's how dictators start. It starts a little bit here, one right taken away. And even the pandemic, where you're locked in your house, goes against the Third Amendment and the First Amendment, the right to assembly. But Arianna, it goes beyond that. They're taking Gone with the Wind and To Kill a Mockingbird and Mark Twain out of theaters. They're They're taking down statues of people like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. They want to shut down the country because of statues. They're a party of revolutionaries and tyrants. The whole Democrat Party is. It's sad because they're one of the two political parties who one day could be president of this country, and we just don't know when that'll be.
It's scary. And you mentioned Gone with the Wind. I'll be honest. That is one of the most beautiful movies in cinematic history. And I understand the criticism that some believe it glorifies slavery and racism. But I think focusing on that, instead of using that as a learning opportunity, as in a discussion point to share with new generations and with each other, censoring that content, censoring a movie that was so insignificant historically, does not do anybody a service. On the contrary, it's trying to whitewash our history in a very ugly manner.
I agree with every word you said. I mean, even if it is a very beautiful movie, and I do see some of the objections, but if it wasn't beautiful and there were no objections, just don't teach it, don't ban it. I mean, Disney's, my favorite Disney film that was not an animated, was a movie, you've heard of it, called Song of the South.
Oh, yeah. It's banned.
It's banned completely, and a whole generation is lost from seeing it because this will make your audience very sick. It made slaves look happy, they said. And there was no more lovable character than Uncle Remus, which, if anyone doesn't know who that is, that's who the ride Splash Mountain Disney World was based off of. And it is one of those beautiful movies I've ever seen. I mean, even a movie like Birth of a Nation, you've heard of it, the pro-Ku Klux Klan movie from 1915.
Yes.
I'd be the first to tell you, and you'd be the second to tell everybody. Show it if it comes out. If you don't like it, don't see it. We have free elections. David Duke got elected in Louisiana. I detest the man. He put me in a gas chamber if he could. But freedom means you, things are going to happen. You don't like people going to say things you don't like. That's a price you pay for our republic.
But see, my First Amendment is so important. And mind you, as an attorney, I have to say this, freedom of speech is not unlimited. There are restrictions on it. With that said, freedom to watch a film, freedom to discuss it, freedom to share opinions, freedom to have discussions, and being able to respect other people's opinions without it escalating to violence, that is a quintessential American principle. So the fact that we've lost sight of that, we've lost touch of that because we think, and when I say we, I'm talking about the left, the societal we, right? There's this mentality that you can go online and bully people into submission. That is counterintuitive and anti-American.
Completely. They're using the, you know, Ted Cruz, who I very much admire, is even considering government getting involved, which I don't normally like, to get Google and Facebook and Twitter accountable for not censoring ideas. Because that's where people put most of their platforms. They don't have the websites with talk shows like you and I do. And it's just the importance of people being able to say what they want in this country, that's just very differentiates us from Iran and Cuba.
Absolutely. And the fact that the left, you know, the free love folks, the everybody, let's be friends, the kumbaya crowd, the fact that they reject that and are now trying to censor people and cancel their own, because celebrity after celebrity who has not towed the line with whatever flavor of the week talking point the left is pushing has been canceled, attacked, threatened. It's a vicious culture that it's eating their own at this point.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Christy Alley, the former star of Cheers, made an excellent point. She said, it's not a question of even disagreeing with a philosophy. You can't even disagree with their candidate. So just lie and say you're anti-Trump. That is scary. That makes the McCarthy era look like 30 years ago. I mean, this is just frightening because, even, you know, Adolf Manju was a Nazi. And Jane Fonda was a traitor to our country, and they had a right to be in movies. Adolph Manju was the star of Pollyanna, The Golden Follies, and many other films. I mean, Jane Fonda needs no introduction. But wouldn't this be a great country if we were totally free to say what we want, thought we wanted, and not get punished for it?
Absolutely. And as you know, a young professional speaking from that point of view, As I get ready, you know, to transition and at some point in the near future have children, I don't want my kids to grow up in a world where they cannot express an opinion that's counter to the majority. That is antithetical to what we are as Americans. This is a place where all ideas are welcome, and let's have it out. Let's debate them. Let's have the discussion. But bringing kids into a world where they have to censor themselves because they could potentially insult somebody unintentionally so with a microaggression, that's completely counter to our culture, our values, and our way of life.
I strongly believe, and I totally agree with everything you're saying. It's like I gave the example of the Ku Klux. If the Ku Klux Klan were to march down that street next to me, or the Communist Party were to do that, I'd be the first to defend not their ideas, but their right to do it. And we're talking about much less than that. We're talking about conservatives who are considered the most discriminated against group in the country. It's a strong saying, but they are. And I mean, you can't even say something. Imagine if a student said, I'm for the National Rifle Association, or an actor came out and said, by the way, I'm pro-life. They wouldn't have any job offerings or get a good grade. It's very sad, Arianna.
But it makes no sense. It's almost like we're going to bully you into submission, into thinking the way we do, or at least pretending that you think the way we do, because it makes us feel better.
That's right, because it makes them feel better. Bullying them into submission is another way of bullying, and bullying is always wrong, whether kids do it to kids or people do it through ideas. I mean, it's sort of like, it would be like if a family member disowned another family member, which I'm sure happens, because they hate their political views. And so I'll tell you, my grandparents, to say something personal, I'm not going to mention names, some of them were very left-wing, and it did affect one of my relationships. And, you know, and I felt a little like that, but it's just the kind of thing where I think the whole country is forced to think either you are a revolutionary or you're a fascist who supports free speech, or a fascist who supports freedom. You're a fascist who wants blacks, Jews, and women to think for themselves. And the word fascist is an oxymoron in this case.
So what has been the biggest criticism that you have received as a radio show host from the left?
A hate monger.
Really?
Yes, because of my opposition to the Equality Act.
Okay. And on a personal level, how have you dealt with that?
What happened, as long as you spell my name right, that's okay. I know it's not true. I have a very thick skin persona. If everybody thought that, I would not like it. But if one kook thinks it, let them.
Right, right. And do you think that is now normal in our culture, that when we disagree with people politically, especially if that person has a platform, to attack them on a personal level?
All the time. In fact, it goes beyond that. You remember Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson were lied about, even with sexual assault, because of their conservatism. Everybody on Fox is pretty much targeted. Not every conservative talk host is, but if you are on Fox and you express conservative viewpoints, I would not want to be that host.
Absolutely. So what is, give me two policy points you love about Trump and two that you hate.
Okay. I love the fact that he eliminated the individual mandate. I'm going to use a little spin here, a little different kind of new arguments that you don't hear all the time. I don't like the fact he destroyed the ISIS caliphate. Those are two great accomplishments, two great policies. I don't like that he shut the country down. Which I guess goes with my second policy. I wish he would sign an executive order to reopen America.
Fair enough. Would you subscribe to the label of libertarian?
No.
What do you
think? Some things about them I agree with, but I'm too socially conservative on issues like abortion and the so-called LGBT rights movement and so many other areas. And I'm definitely against legalizing marijuana. I debated that on my show with somebody from the group Normal. I would like, I'm more social conservative, which to me is synonymous with economic conservatism than libertarians would think it is or would be from my point of view.
Do you think the Republican Party has become more libertarian?
Not now, because Mike Pence and Donald Trump, because Mike Pence had a big influence in it not being. I think Ted Cruz and Donald Trump is very conservative on social issues. And he just said the other day that the pro-life issue is going to be a top priority in the second term. And abortion was such a hot button issue a year ago. And not as big, but the Equality Act was too, a horrible, odious bill. I won't even get into that. But I think social conservatism is coming back.
Gotcha. So if people want to hear to your show, how can they tune in?
Well, thank you, Ariana. They go to blogtalkradio.com/MikeEssen show. It's on every Mondays, live Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 4 p.m.
Guys, it's a great show, so if you haven't heard it, please tune in.
Thank you, Ariana. I love your show. You have a great show, too, and I'm honored to be on it. I listen to it quite often.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Thanks for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. And I think the biggest takeaway from the show, let's not hate each other just simply because we disagree. Politics is politics. It's a dirty game. We can have differences of opinion, but we should be able to sit down at a table and share a cup of coffee and say, hey, you have a different worldview. I have a different worldview. I'm going to do everything I can to persuade other people that my idea is the best, but I still respect you, dude. I still can go out and have a coffee with you. You're not a bad person. I just understand you have a different point of view. The real evil people in the world are the people that kill, murder, steal. Those are true evil. But a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, those are not bad people. They just have differences of opinion. It's politics. It's dirty. It's complex. And I get it. It's emotional. But that should not control our lives. People should not be targeted like that Trump supporter simply because he supports President Trump. And that goes the same for the left. You shouldn't be targeted because you identify as a liberal. That's not right. It's targeting of any sort. It's wrong and it shouldn't happen. And it's inherently un-American. So guys, November's coming up. Do your homework. Research the candidates. You know who I'm voting for. With that said, go out and do your homework. I believe President Trump is the best man for the job. I think he will be the best man to rebuild this economy, to push the country forward from this pandemic world. That is my point of view. I like his positions on immigration. I like his position on foreign policy. I like his position on education. Those are my viewpoints, and they need to be respected, just like I respect yours. With that said, do your homework, have educated opinions. Don't just take somebody's word for it. Just because a talking head says it's true doesn't make it true. And that goes for me too. So be an independent thinker. Have friends from across the aisle. You may get a little bit of insight where people come from. And have the most important thing, have empathy for other people. And having empathy does not mean that you have to sacrifice your points of view. And I think this is a very important thing to keep in mind as things get heated and as the presidential race gets even more rhetorically charged. We need to keep that in mind. We're all Americans here. At the end of the day, we all want the best thing for our country, for our families, for our communities. That's all we want. So guys, thanks for tuning in. And remember, we're available on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you hear your podcast. And as I always say, we're not your dad's political news show. We're a slightly different flavor. So spread the word. Share it with your friends. We always enjoy welcoming new listeners to the show. Join us next week for another episode. And guys, stay safe. Happy Labor Day weekend.